A skeletal Jewish prisoner is summoned from his work detail. A nurse leads him through a converted hospital, past rows of wounded German soldiers, to a darkened room where a young SS officer lies dying, his face completely wrapped in blood-stained bandages. The Nazi didn't ask for Simon Wiesenthal specifically. He asked for a Jew. Any Jew would do. What follows is a confession so horrifying that it has haunted moral philosophers, theologians, and ordinary readers for over half a century. The dying man describes herding 300 Jewish families into a building, dousing it with gasoline, and setting it ablaze. He watched a father, mother, and child leap together from a window, their bodies consumed by flames and bullets. Now, facing death, he seeks absolution. Simon listens in silence, then walks away without offering forgiveness. Was this the right choice? This question, raw, unresolved, and deeply personal, forms the moral center of the Sunflower, transforming a wartime encounter into one of history's most profound ethical dilemmas. Carl's deathbed revelation revealed how ordinary people become perpetrators of genocide. Raised Catholic by a social democrat father who opposed the Nazis, Carl had been an altar boy familiar with confession and redemption. Yet at 14, defying his parents, he joined the Hitler Youth. The transformation was gradual but complete, from religious boy to enthusiastic participant in mass murder. His confession exposed the mechanics of moral collapse, ideology replacing conscience, group participation normalizing atrocity, distance from victims enabling unspeakable acts. Carl described the burning building with clinical precision, yet his voice broke, recalling the family jumping together, the child held between parents. This detail haunted him because it pierced his psychological armor. For a moment, he saw not Jews, but a family, not a category, but human beings. His Catholic upbringing, dormant during years of killing, suddenly roared back as death approached. But was this genuine remorse or merely fear of eternal punishment? The question cuts to the heart of what constitutes real repentance. Simon faced an unsolvable dilemma. Jewish tradition teaches that only the wronged party can grant forgiveness, and Carl's victims were dead, their ashes scattered across Poland. Even God cannot forgive sins committed against others. Yet Carl's request placed an unbearable weight on Simon, to speak for the murdered, to represent all Jews, to calculate whether one man's 11th-hour remorse balanced against 300 lives extinguished in flames. This mathematics reveals forgiveness's fundamental impossibility. How many tears equal one murdered child? What quantity of regret cancels a burning building? Framing forgiveness as something granted or withheld suggests a transaction, but genocide isn't a debt that can be repaid. Carl's request contained a disturbing assumption that any Jew could substitute for any other, that Simon could forgive crimes against strangers. This interchangeability, reducing individuals to a category, was precisely the logic that enabled the Holocaust. Even in seeking forgiveness, Carl perpetuated the dehumanization that made his crimes possible. Years later, Simon visited Carl's mother in Stuttgart. She lived in bombed-out ruins, clutching her son's SS uniform photo, calling him her dear good boy. She described how the Hitler Youth changed Carl, how his father died brokenhearted watching his son embrace Nazi ideology. Weeping, she insisted, "We are not responsible for what happened to Jews." Simon faced another impossible choice: reveal her son's crimes or preserve her consolation. He chose silence again, but a different kind. Where his first silence withheld forgiveness, this one offered mercy. He invented a story about meeting Carl as a railway worker, protecting her illusions. This second silence remains controversial. Some argue he should have shattered her denial, forcing her to confront Carl's true nature. Others see extraordinary compassion, showing mercy to a murderer's mother, sparing her unbearable knowledge. These two silences bookend the Sunflower's moral landscape, the first maintaining justice, the second offering grace. Here lies the book's most paradoxical insight. Simon refused forgiveness, yet showed profound humanity. He stayed with the dying Nazi, held his hand, chased away flies, listened without interruption. These acts of care, offered by a starving prisoner to his oppressor, represent something more complex than forgiveness or condemnation. They acknowledge shared humanity without erasing moral responsibility. You can recognize someone's suffering without absolving their crimes, extend compassion without granting pardon, maintain human connection while preserving moral clarity. This isn't weakness, it's sophisticated ethical thinking that refuses false binaries. Simon's response suggests that the opposite of hatred isn't necessarily forgiveness. Sometimes it's simply acknowledgement. By staying present, he gave Carl witness to his confession, recognition of his remorse, confirmation of his continued humanity despite his inhumane acts. Yet by refusing explicit forgiveness, Simon maintained that some crimes transcend individual absolution. This delicate balance, compassion without capitulation, offers a model for responding to profound moral injury that honors both justice and mercy without collapsing them into one. What would you have done? This question transforms readers from passive observers into active moral agents. Suddenly, you're in that hospital room, feeling the weight of a dying man's hand, hearing his labored confession, watching flies circle his bandaged head. The question demands an answer, and there is no right one. The symposium's responses reveal this beautifully. Desmond Tutu leans toward forgiveness as practical politics necessary for societal healing. Primo Levi, an Auschwitz survivor himself, supports Simon's refusal, questioning whether deathbed remorse constitutes genuine repentance. The Dalai Lama offers Buddhist perspectives on compassion that transcend Western forgiveness frameworks. Each response reflects lived experience, shaped by religion, culture, personal trauma, and historical moment. This diversity doesn't indicate moral relativism, but rather the profound complexity of questions at the intersection of justice, mercy, individual responsibility, and collective healing. The genius of the sunflower lies in making philosophical abstractions viscerally real, forcing us to examine not just what we believe, but why we believe it. We live in an age that demands certainty, that mistakes confidence for wisdom. The sunflower offers something more valuable, the courage to sit with ambiguity. Simon Wiesenthal spent his life hunting Nazi war criminals, yet never stopped questioning his choice in that hospital room, never claimed certainty about his silence. This ongoing uncertainty isn't weakness, it's moral seriousness. It suggests that anyone too confident about what they would have done hasn't truly grappled with the question's weight. As genocides continue in Rwanda, Bosnia, Cambodia, and Myanmar, the sunflower remains urgently relevant. It asks whether we can maintain our humanity while refusing to forget atrocity, whether justice and reconciliation can coexist, whether nations can acknowledge collective responsibility without descending into collective guilt. When you close this book, you carry Simon's question forward. What would you have done? More importantly, what will you do when faced with your own impossible moral choices? The power to forgive or withhold forgiveness, to show compassion or demand justice. These aren't abstract philosophical concepts. They're daily decisions that define who we become.